From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, guitarist Nels Klein. He's best known for playing in the band Wilco. Klein's also well known for his avant-garde playing. Now Klein has a new album that's kind of out of character. It's a collection of ballads, covers, and originals called Lovers. We'll talk with Klein about his music and how he fits into a rock band like Wilco.
People think that my whole raison d'etre is to bring some sort of chaotic sound design to Wilco's ensemble sound, but it wasn't. When it comes to music, I think I want the music to sound like it should sound.
Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Jonathan Safran Foer's new novel, Here I Am. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Nels Klein, is best known as a guitarist in the indie rock band Wilco. He brought a more experimental sound to the band, adding the kind of feedback, distortion, and noise that he's explored in the avant-garde groups he's led. In 2007, Rolling Stone named him one of 20 new guitar gods, and in 2011, he made the magazine's list of the 100 greatest guitarists of all time. Nels Klein's new album is a departure. It's a collection of lushly arranged versions of American popular song, covers of more recent songs, including one by Sonic Youth, and originals. The album is called Lovers. The arrangements are by Michael Leonard, and the album features 23 musicians, including Klein's wife, Yuka Honda, who's in the band Chibomato, and his twin brother, drummer Alex Klein. Let's start with a track from the new album. This is Glad to Be Unhappy. Nels Klein, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to describe the concept of your new album, Lovers.
Well, it's something that I've been pondering and dreaming about for, well, maybe over 25 years, certainly. It's about maybe my idea of a mood music record, but not a cheesy one. It's an attempt to show feelings, update, and be more thorough the idea of romance, sexuality, intimacy, and how that relates to songs. Not to say that I have achieved that, but I am aspiring to that.
So you said it's kind of like your take on mood music, but not the cheesy kind. In my mind, mood music was always considered cheesy. it's not about just, you know, to me, like beautiful music, you could say ballads. But mood music always implied this kind of cheesy thing for swinging bachelors or for, like, there's always, like, a picture on the album cover of, like, a beautiful woman and lying in front of the fire or a woman lying on with her head on her lover's lap or something, you know, and supposed to, like, put it on to get in the mood. And
right.
So that's the cheesy part. Why are you thinking of it in terms of mood music? Why not just come out and say they're beautiful ballads?
Well, I think it has something to do with how I initially thought of the record, because I was working for almost 10 years in a record store in West Los Angeles called Rhino Records, and we had all those $1 mood music records, many of which I put up on the bathroom wall for the covers that you're describing. But I also discovered later that some of them weren't cheesy, and I also felt that it would be interesting to update the idea of this record and make it darker in terms of the emotional and artistic content.
So you're best known for more like free jazz kind of stuff and for adding distortion and feedback and noise to Wilco with your guitar and all the gizmos or whatever that you have that you can attach to it. And in this, like, you're playing on a lot of it much more straightforwardly and much more melodically. And I'm wondering if melody is starting to take on new meaning for you as a musician.
Well, I mean, I think it's always been there. But maybe you're correct in that there is a, I guess, continued interest that has taken on new meaning and maybe a certain kind of relevance as I have hit age 60.
The age when melody sets in.
But it's always been there, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I just feel that in my own work, there have been, I guess, more extremes. But every one of my records pretty much has some kind of at least floaty ballad on it that I consider to be melodic, but they might be at least a little abstract.
I think one of my favorite tracks on here is Beautiful Love, which is a Victor Young song. And he wrote some great songs, My Foolish Heart, When I Fall in Love, Street of Dreams, I Don't Stand a Ghost of a Chance with You, and the theme for Johnny Guitar, which is which Peggy Lee sings in the movie and is really great.
Wow, I forgot about that.
Yeah, and this is not one of his, you know, best-known songs, but it's a beautiful song. So tell us why you chose it. And I'd also like you to describe the instrumentation we're going to hear in the opening, because it's very ear-catching, and I recognize some of the instruments, but I don't know exactly what's going on.
Well, we've got a reference at the beginning of Beautiful Love to its original appearance, as far as I understand it, which is in the Boris Karloff movie The Mummy. And in that iteration, it's in 3/4 time, which our introduction is. And I asked Kenny Wollison, who plays vibraphone on this, to put the motor on very fast, which is a sound I associate with the 1930s and 40s, and a sound that one does not hear so much these days. It was kind of, I guess, deemed uncool at some point. I don't know what happened there. And we've got the bassoon, and we've got flute, and it's just very charming at the beginning, and then we go into what I could, I guess, generally describe as a jazz guitar bass drums trio with Devin Hoff and my brother Alex Klein. So it's a kind of combination in my mind of a retro tribute and then an update relating to my love of jazz music.
Well, let's hear it. It's a great track. It's called Beautiful Love. And this is from, I guess, Nels Klein's new album, Lovers.
Thank you.
Beautiful Love from Nels Klein's new album, Lovers. What you're playing there in your more solo part sounds almost inspired by Wes Montgomery.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, many great jazz guitarists I could name. I have to say that Jim Hall is a huge inspiration and a touchstone for much of this record for me. And Jim and I were sort of getting to know each other not long before he passed away. And while I was making this record, there were certain pieces that I really couldn't wait to play for him. But he passed away in the last day of tracking in his sleep in his apartment a block from where I've been living in Manhattan. And Secret Love on the record is actually an homage to him directly because we play it in the key of A flat major that he enjoyed playing it in. And I always thought that the polyrhythmic heartbeat polychord that I came up with would really, really kind of bring a smile to his face. But certainly Wes, I love George Benson, and I think that Django Reinhardt, when he went electric in the 50s, is very underrated, and I really love that sound. So certain aspects of guitar are part of the sort of layered homage on much of this record.
You know, you mentioned Jim Hall, and I think of him as being one of the most spare guitarists. And I think of you as just a kind of multi-layered, very almost dense guitarist, because there's so many layers of sound and distortion in some of your work. So it's interesting to me that you would feel such a connection to his music.
Jim was a genius, and he was also, yes, as you point out, really a master of understatement. And I think maybe in this case, my deep love of him is not merely aesthetic and musical, but also there's that kind of love of the other, you know, because yes, I have a million notes buzzing in my head. And when you hear Lady Gabor on the Lovers record, you hear me doing live looping and all these kinds of things that I enjoy doing that are, I guess, part of my style, I guess, you know, I don't know. But I do aspire to growing up someday to being more like Jim. I wish.
Why don't we take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. My guest is guitarist Nels Klein. He plays with Wilco and he leads his own groups. And now he has a new album of ballads, covers, and originals called Lovers. We'll be right back after this break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is guitarist Nels Klein. He's best known for his work with Wilco, but he also plays avant-garde jazz and leads his own group. And now he has an album that's kind of out of character. It's an album of ballads, covers, and originals called Lovers. So let's talk about your work with Wilco. I know there's a lot of Wilco fans in our audience. You joined the band in 2004. What stage was the band in, you know, musically and personally when you joined?
Well, I didn't know personally anything about these guys, and I could say that when I joined Wilco, there was some drama. Jeff was unbeknownst to me, going through some real problems with prescription painkiller addiction. So right when I joined, we were going to go on tour, he went into a hospital and basically got clean, and tour was canceled, and people were really worried that I had hitched my wagon to some sort of dysfunctional vehicle, but in reality, it's quite the opposite. I had total faith in Jeff, and my faith was well-placed. You know, we soldiered on. He's been completely cool. He even quit smoking many, many years ago, and 12 years have gone by of solid music making with the same six dudes. It's really, really been amazing.
Yeah, you mentioned that Jeff Tweedy went to rehab for a prescription painkiller addiction. You know, I know he's had to deal with depression, panic attacks, and stage fright, too. And I'm wondering if he still has, I don't know if you're comfortable talking about this, but if he still has to deal with stage fright, and what's that like for you? Because everybody probably gets a little bit nervous, at least before a big performance. But, you know, he's the front man, so you want him to be in a good space.
Jeff is, I think, found a proper way to deal with things with some kind of medication. I don't know what it is, that's very effective. And I think the stage fright thing is not such a big deal. But then again, maybe he just makes it look easy, because we really just are very relaxed before the shows, and he's doing great. I think even the migraines, which I think was a really big problem for him, only rear their ugly head once in a while at this point. And that can be, of course, debilitating. But overall, he's a really functional and very solid and at this point, insanely prolific artist.
So let's play something from the new Wilco album, Wilco Schmilco. Who came up with that title?
Jeff.
Okay.
It's very Jeff.
What inspired that, do you know?
Well, I guess it's Nilsson Schmilsson, I really was surprised. That was the working title all along, working on the record, but I was pretty surprised that it stuck, you know. But I mean, the previous record is Star Wars, which is another hilarious Jeff title.
I'm going to play a track from the new album, Wilco Schmilco. And you and Jeff Tweedy are both playing guitar on this. So tell us what to listen for, like which part's you, which part's Jeff Tweedy, and what are you doing? Because it sounds like the guitar is like detuned on it.
Yes. I'm not exactly sure what the original first piece of this song was, or where it originated, I should say, because a lot of times Jeff records stuff on his phone when he's on tour, and I think this possibly is one of the tracks that emerged from his iPhone, and then we start playing along with it. And quite often, as you'll hear on other tracks from Wilco Schmilco, we're not in 440 or 442 pitch, because Jeff he hadn't tuned his guitar to that when he recorded some idea that he had. And I think this is an example of that, where there are many textures from the guitars, acoustic and electric. I'm playing a prepared acoustic guitar with alligator clips. I believe that it was an acoustic guitar with a pickup in it, so we amplified it through a small guitar amp and recorded it acoustically in order to bring out some of the microtonal overtones. And this way you could probably liken it to maybe Fred Frith's work in the 70s, or even John Cage prepared piano with the erasers and whatnot.
Yeah, and just to clarify for people who don't know, if the prepared piano and erasers means you're sticking the erasers in the piano strings to distort
Correct.
The sound. When you're preparing your guitar with the alligator clips, where are the alligator clips?
You can put them anywhere they sound good, but I generally prefer to start over the sound hole area of an acoustic guitar. Clip right on the strings. So that's what you're hearing me do on this. There is electric guitar, where you hear the fast tremolo picking guitar in the middle with the weird hand claps and all that stuff. That's me and Jeff. Just going kind of crazy. I'm not sure that we were thinking about the harmonic content at that point. I think we were just kind of moving around, and I was following his lead. And Glenn, I think, is doing some kind of strange, some sort of stick technique where he's vibrating a thin stick against the rim of one of his drums. There's a lot going on there, Terry. we haven't figured out how to play this song live yet.
But I want to get back to the phone. So Jeff Tweedy records something on his phone, and mm-hmm. then you're playing with a phone recording that he's made while he was on the road?
Yes, sometimes.
So part of what we're hearing is what he recorded on his phone?
I think on this track, as I recall, it's probably from a phone recording initially, and we play along with it in the loft, in the recording facility in the loft.
So you're listening to it on headphones as you play?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, you never know how a song is going to come together with Wilco, I'll tell you.
Okay. So let's hear how it came together. This is from the new Wilco album, Wilco Schmilco. This is Common Sense.
I slammed my finger in the door of love. Goddamn the judging, stranger judge.
My guest is guitarist Nels Klein. He plays in the indie rock band Wilco, as well as in avant-garde jazz groups. His new album of ballads, covers, and originals is called Lovers. After a break, we'll talk more about his music and about growing up with a twin brother, Alex Klein. They played together as kids, and Alex is on Nels' new album. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed with email marketing, working to help organizations meet their goals through personalized marketing help via phone, seminars, and webinars. More at constantcontact.com. And from Whole Foods Market, where yellow signs identify featured items throughout stores each week, from grass-fed burgers to gluten-free buns. Whole Foods Market, committed to quality standards and planet-friendly practices.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with guitarist Nels Klein. He's best known for his work with the indie rock band Wilco. He also leads avant-garde jazz groups. His new album is a collection of lushly arranged jazz ballads, covers, and originals. It's called Lovers. When we left off, we were talking about his work with Wilco and how he brought an experimental sound to the group. So what did Wilco bring out in your playing? Like, how did you adjust yourself to find the right sound for Wilco?
It's actually kind of interesting that I think primarily my goal was not to bring my personality as a whatever, you know, jazz type, soundscape type person to the band, but that kind of ended up happening. I feel that mostly the Wilco songbook kind of brought out my sort of 14-year-old aesthetic self, the rock and roll obsessive that was listening ardently to Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds and the Beatles and Rolling Stones, that music that I grew up with. And interestingly, I think trying to channel either my initial idol, Jimi Hendrix, or trying to fake some Clarence White or, you know what I mean, some great Glen Campbell stuff or something. And then Jeff has to tell me sometimes, you know, you're being too reverent to this material. And sometimes I think he wants me to destroy the song, as he did on a song like Dawned on Me, where I think I was trying to come up with some little jingle jangly thing. And while I was messing around, I was strangulating my 60s guitar and with an amp that was basically, I blew up the amp doing this. And he said, that's the sound that should be in the solo section. So, I mean, that would not have been my first impulse. And I think that people think it is, that my whole raison d'etre is to bring some sort of chaotic sound design to Wilco's ensemble sound, but it wasn't. I really enjoy addressing this more classicist aspect of popular music, whether it's country folk or rock and roll, and just trying to make the song sound like the song should sound. You know what I mean? It's not all about some kind of avant-garde mindset or about changing the sound of the band or bringing whatever my thing is into it, because I really don't think I have a thing when it comes to music. I think I want the music to sound like it should sound to everyone in the band, and then particularly to Jeff if he wrote the song. That's what's successful to me.
Did you have to find not only like a music space for yourself within the band Wilco, but also like an on-stage personality to have? Because let's face it, the smaller, more avant-garde groups that you play with probably play in like small clubs and small performance spaces where everybody's wearing a t-shirt. And granted, you all wear t-shirts on stage anyways, but you know
not
what I mean?
Me.
Oh, not you. But those small spaces, I mean, it's just different than being in like a really big theater or an arena.
It's sort of, this is going to sound maybe a little like I'm kind of not telling the truth, but I am telling the truth. I don't really care how many people are there, and I kind of play the same no matter what. But yes, rock and roll has pageantry, I like to call it.
Yeah, exactly,
In Wilco, yeah, we have lights, we have atmosphere, we have, you know, fake smoke, all that stuff that rock bands
do. You
do
the fake smoke thing?
Well, light designers insist on it so they get definition from the way the lights look. It's just a thing. We don't do like fog, like dry ice fog, like The Cure or something. But you know, I was playing rock and roll with Mike Watt and in the 90s with the Geraldine Fibbers. And when I play rock and roll, I move around a lot. And I just do, you know. And when I play with Julian Lage, I'm sitting down. You know, I just like to do all these different things. And my concentration and my, I have to say, my dedication to the moment and to the sound is the same no matter what I'm doing. And I think without sounding disingenuous, I get a kind of fundamental, if not moronic, pleasure from sound as soon as it starts. So even in sound checks, once we start playing, I'm in the zone. I'm happy, you know, because I like playing and I like sound and I like all different kinds of sounds. And that is what drives me, and that's what's probably saved me.
So when you're soloing, is there a time limit on your solo? Like, especially for recordings, you know, does Jeff Tweedy say, okay, like no more than 35 seconds?
Well, the song form is usually kind of set except on Art of Almost from the record The Whole Love, where he basically created a coda that we played separately and edited on to the end of the song. So I would, as he put it, shred. So he asked me to shred, and I think that the length of that was determined prior to my shredding, but it could have been longer or shorter if I'd wanted it to be. You know, other songs, like, you know, I just mentioned Dawned on Me, that solo section, which is just shrill noise at this point on the recording, is of a set length. And I find that this is a huge challenge for me. I start thinking about people like George Harrison when I'm given this little space of maybe 10 seconds or 15 seconds to do something, you know, beautiful, coherent, exciting, whatever is required, because I am not good at self-editing. So it's a really, really a great challenge, and it varies from song to song.
Well, why don't we hear the song that you were referring to, Dawned on Me. So this is Wilco with my guest Nels Cline on guitar.
Every night is a test.
Wilco with my guest Nels Cline on guitar. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Nels Cline. He has a new album of his own called Lovers. It's an album of ballads, covers, and originals. And of course, he also plays guitar with Wilco. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Home Instead Senior Care, providing an individualized approach designed to meet a family's needs, offering a range of in-home care services from help around the house to Alzheimer's care to keep aging loved ones at home. HomeInstead.com/NPR. And from the law firm Cooley LLP, with offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is guitarist Nels Cline. He's best known for his work with Wilco. He also plays a lot of avant-garde music. His new album, Lovers, is kind of a change of pace for him. It's an album of lushly arranged ballads, covers, and originals. So you started playing guitar when you were 12, and your twin brother, Alex, I think, started playing drums at about the same time. So that must have been pretty great to have a twin brother who you could play with.
Absolutely amazing, because not only did we do everything together, including obsess about rock and roll and then later jazz and improvised music, but he was always really good. So I always had this really amazing drummer to play with. And then without getting all mystical and weird, there is a kind of a psychic thing with twins, which I can't deny. And so there was this kind of communication that is absolutely unique and really kind of a seamless kind of like bonding consciousness that I experienced playing with him for really up until into my 30s, I guess. And we stopped playing together a lot because I was on another path. And he's a very serious retiring kind of person and never endeavored to make a living playing music. So he plays all the time in Southern California or on the West Coast, but works at UCLA in the oral history program.
But he plays on your new album.
Yeah, he was the only person I ever wanted on this project from the very beginning. And it's because of his, he has a lot of big band experience from all his playing in high school and beyond. And it's his use of color, his ability to use symbols in a certain way, his ability to phrase to keep the band really together, and his feel and sound. Like everything about it, I just knew he was the guy. And so far, I flew him and his family out to New York to make the record, and we performed some of the music at the Newport Jazz Festival several weeks ago, and I could fly him out for that, and we're performing it in California next year, so he'll be able to do those. So far, I've been able to have Alex on this music every time we try it.
Are you identical twins?
Yeah, we're actually a type of identical twin called mirror twins.
What does that mean?
From what I understand, it is a type of twin where the egg separates at a very, very late stage in development, and he's right-handed, I'm left-handed. We're opposite personalities to a great extent. His hair parts naturally on an opposite side from mine. We're called mirror twins because if you come up behind me and I'm looking at myself in the mirror, I look like my brother and vice versa.
Wow, that's really, I didn't know there was such a phenomenon.
Yeah, it's weird.
So did that ever make you feel like you were half a person when you weren't together?
No, but people would make you feel like that, you know, like when you're a kid, they say, like, where's your other half? So my brother and I spent a lot of energy differentiating ourselves from each other and asserting our individuality in the world, I think, so that we would be seen as individuals and not one part of a two-unit whole, you know?
So what did you do to differentiate yourself from your brother?
Well, it's actually humorous probably to think about it, but for example, music, since we're talking about music, we liked all the same music for the most part, but there are certain bands that were there were my bands, and there are other bands that were his bands. And even though we listened to everything at the same time together, for example, Frank Zappa, the Mothers of Invention, that was an obsession of my brother's. Well, he was always going to be the Zappa guy, or he was always going to be the Jethro Tull guy, or, he tormented me with Black Sabbath at the time. But and rarely did we switch over. For example, he loved the Grateful Dead when they were psychedelic, and then when Working Man's Dead came out, I loved that, and I became the Grateful Dead listener. That was a rare event. You know, the same thing happened with Joni Mitchell, where I was listening to Joni Mitchell, and then when she started playing the Hegira era stuff with Jaco Pastorius and whatnot, he became obsessed with that music. And I said, hey, man, it's a great record, but go for it. You know, you can have the Joni records now.
So you're mirroring with your taste in the Grateful Dead and Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, we just sort that was the only sort of crossover from the Sovereign record universe that we lived in. But I didn't love everything Alex listened to, and I tortured him with Johnny Winter and Live, and he tortured me with Blue Cheer, but we still sat and listened to this music together all the time and talked about it, and that was one way. The other way was, of course, clothing. We didn't dress alike, but it was an amazing and magical connection, you know. And I know that it's frustrating when people can't tell you apart and you think you look completely different from this other guy. But that's just a tiny irritant in what is really a kind of really special and marvelous existence.
So how did you dress to set yourself apart from your brother? And is that reflected in how you dress on stage today?
Interestingly, Alex was a very flamboyant dresser in terms of color when he was really young. And then when puberty hit, he started dressing really drably. My brother now he's been a vegetarian for most of his entire adult life, as far as I recall, and now vegan. And he's kind of one of these kind of hemp pants and croc wearing kind of people. And I think my initial look was based more on kind of drab hippie stuff. Like in the school, I was wearing a lot of denim work shirts and football jerseys to imitate my idol Leon Russell, you know. And I don't dress much like that anymore, although it's it would probably work really well with Wilco, but I went into a whole polyester thrift store phase, you know, and started wearing really outlandish clothes, especially with the Geraldine Fibbers, where I was encouraged to do this, and they had Carla Bozulich had such an amazing sense of style. And
wait, does. Are we talking those like 70s and 80s wide lapel polyester suits?
Well, I didn't have any suits, but I did have some crazy shirts. My favorite crazy pants at that time were what I called my Gumby pants, which I had bought in, I believe, Cincinnati. And they were low-rise bell-bottoms, green bell-bottoms with really, really wide. They were elephant bells, I guess you would call them. And I would wear these with a women's pajama top and a big, wide red vinyl belt and work boots.
Wow, what a combo.
Yeah, I was really skinny then too, Terry. I mean, it's things.
But you still are.
Sort of. Well, no, not like I was though. My brother and I were alarmingly thin, and it was not cool. It was sort of the object of ridicule, you know.
So, how did you first discover jazz? Because when you were growing up, jazz was no longer the popular music of its time, and you had to find it.
It's a pretty cool story, actually, Terry. My brother, as I mentioned before, was really into the Mothers of Invention and Captain Beefheart and some of the more forward-looking artists of those days. And a friend of ours, who's no longer on the planet, named David Hirschman, was asked to buy for his father, Jack Hirschman, who's the very avant-garde and renowned poet from the San Francisco area these days. I think he lives in Italy now. He was asked to buy John Coltrane's Greatest Years, Volume 1, for his dad's birthday. His dad just said, "Here's what I want, go get it for me." And when David heard it, he loaned it to Alex, my brother, saying, "I think you might like this record. It's reminded me of some of that instrumental Frank Zappa stuff you like." So I'm still not sure why we were in our friend Bill Watts' apartment at the time without him or anyone else in his family being there, but we were sitting in his apartment in West Los Angeles and put on Africa, which is an edited version on that record. And that was the moment that I decided that I needed to know everything about what had been happening with so-called jazz music, and I became a Coltrane obsessive. And also the piece on that record, After the Rain and Alabama, are utterly profound and changed my whole way of thinking about music.
Well, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. This is a real pleasure. You dragged some things out of me that I'm kind of surprised I got to talk about, and it's really, really cool. Thank you.
Nels Klein's new album is called Lovers. He's also on the new album, Wilco Schmilko. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Jonathan Safran Foer's new novel. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. It's been 11 years since Jonathan Safran Foer published his last novel, the award-winning 9/11-inspired story, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. This was the week that many of Foer's readers have been waiting for. His third novel, Here I Am, has just been published. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Dazzling and draining. Dazzling and draining. That's how my response seesawed. For most of the time, I was reading Jonathan Safran Foer's new novel, until the last 100 pages or so brought home the final verdict. Just dazzling. Foer's novel is called Here I Am, and it's a long and very dense novel about a marriage and family falling apart, a personal disaster paralleled on a grand scale by a catastrophic earthquake in the Middle East that propels Israel and the Arab world into near Armageddon. Foer's title, Here I Am, is taken from one of the most disturbing passages in the Bible, where God commands Abraham to sacrifice his beloved son, Isaac. That passage begins when God calls out to Abraham, and Abraham answers, Hineni, here I am. The core question that Foer's novel explores is to whom do we respond, here I am, when called? Our families, our religious communities, our country? Who or what do we show up for? Here I Am takes place over 4 weeks in the life of the Block family, who live in Washington, D.C. Jacob is a novelist turned television screenwriter. Julia is an architect. They have 3 sons, the eldest of which, Sam, is about to make his bar mitzvah, or that is, he will, if he apologizes for the list of racial epithets he scrawled on his desk at Hebrew school. Jacob and Julia are shocked. They're the kind of enlightened liberals who talk openly and exhaustively with their kids, eat pretentious pasta, and yes, always have NPR on in the car. Sam's offensive list, however, will soon be augmented by another damaging string of words when Julia finds a cell phone hidden at home. Never a good discovery. Sure enough, the phone turns out to contain erotic text messages that Jacob has exchanged with another woman. The Block's marriage fractures. That summary of the opening pages of Here I Am does almost nothing to give you a sense of the frenzied atmosphere of this novel. Foer chronicles the parallel disintegrations of the Block family and the Middle East through an array of voices, memories, leaps into the future, and pages-long catalogs. He riffs on everything from the contents of the Block's medicine cabinet to the old-fashioned and now unpopular names on the headstones in a Jewish cemetery, names like Pincus, Beryl, Jaime, and Wolf. Foer's tone is constantly slip-sliding from melancholy to comedy, as in a brilliant scene in an airport bathroom where Jacob spots Steven Spielberg at the urinal beside him and notices, to his dismay, that Spielberg appears to be uncircumcised. As Foer keeps reminding us, Judaism has a special relationship with words, and he embraces his logophilic legacy here with gusto. But it's also extremely loud and incredibly close, and we readers are asked to stop and applaud so many virtuoso set pieces that the novel is, yes, draining and dazzling. There are many provocative commentaries here, for instance, on political commitment and Jewish identity, particularly when Jacob's Israeli cousin, Tamir, comes to D.C. for a visit. The cousins' life histories are contrasted this way. Tamir had fought for his homeland, while Jacob spent entire nights debating whether that stupid New Yorker poster, where New York is bigger than everything else, would look better on this wall or that one. Tamir tried not to get killed, while Jacob tried not to die of boredom. And yet, as absorbed as this novel is with those larger issues, it too, like Jacob, privileges the personal over the political. Foer takes us deep into the despair that marks the crumbling of the Block family. For instance, in the middle of his first tense conversation with Julia, after the discovery of that cell phone, Jacob thinks these words to himself, a spare elegy on the end of a marriage. So many days in their shared life, so many experiences. How had they managed to spend the previous 16 years unlearning each other? how had all the presence summed to disappearance? Here I Am is a profound novel about the claims of history, identity, family, and the burdens of a broken world that weigh upon even the most cleverly evasive people. As the great boxer Joe Louis said about one of his savviest opponents, he can run, but he can't hide. Nor can any of us.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Here I Am by Jonathan Safran Foer. If you'd like to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed, like our interview with Pamela Adlon, who co-created her new FX series Better Things with Louis C.K., check out our podcast. You'll find lots of interviews to choose from. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, all with a commitment to putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at raymondjames.com. And from Angie's List, now providing everyone access to over 10 million online reviews, hiring tools, local services, and other information. Details at angieslist.com. Angie's List. Home is where our heart is.